Hello, and welcome to Field Lab Earth, the podcast that's all about past and present advances in the fields of agronomic, crop, soil, and environmental sciences. Today we're having our very first bonus episode, talking to Drs. Elizabeth Stahlberg and Julie McClure about a topic near and dear to their hearts, the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is an important piece of American legislation, but what does it actually do? How does it get passed? Where did it come from? And where are we with the Farm Bill today? Answers to all these and more coming right up. I'm your host, Abby Morrison. Let's talk about policy. Hi, welcome to the show. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great, thank you.
Another blisteringly hot day in Washington, D.C.
It's pretty hot here in Madison today as well, so glad we're on the same page with that. So I'm super excited to get to talk to you guys today. This is my first time actually recording people that I work with, even though I haven't met you face-to-face yet. Hopefully that'll happen someday. But why don't we just start, and you guys can tell me a little bit about yourselves.
Sure. Yeah, my name is Elizabeth Stahlberg. I've only been working in the policy office for about a year and a half now. I have a PhD in molecular biology, and I did a fellowship on the Hill, so I worked in a congressional office for a year. I had a couple fellowships around Washington, D.C., in the Obama White House Office of Science and Technology Policy at USDA's Office of the Chief Scientist, and I really love working in food and agriculture policy.
And I'm Julie McClure. I have my PhD actually in biochemistry. I did a policy fellowship with the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology right after grad school. And then I've been here with Agronomy, Crop, and Soil Science Society since fall of 2012. So almost 6 years, which has been excellent. I've really enjoyed my time here. Both Elizabeth and I work in the science policy office, and we're really kind of liaisons between the scientific and policy communities here in Washington, D.C.
And for those who aren't super familiar with our science policy office, can you give me a high-level overview of what you guys do there?
I feel like what we do really kind of splits into two or maybe even three categories. The first thing we do is communicate with our membership. So things that are happening in Washington, D.C., we like to keep our members just aware of what's going on. If there's a new appointment at USDA that's important or a new funding opportunity that comes out, we really like to get that information to our members. But then the communication sort of goes both ways. So if there's new science or even just an important observation that a member makes about the way science is funded or the way the policies around science research are done, we can bring that to policymakers too.
Yeah, I think of the Science Policy Office as translators, really. We're translating policy issues to the scientific community, so the members of Agronomy, Crop, and Soils. And then I think we translate the scientific issues to policymaking communities.
Perfect. Thank you for everything that you guys do. So we're going to be talking about a specific piece of legislation today, the Farm Bill. Can you give me a high-level overview of what the Farm Bill is?
So the Farm Bill is one piece of legislation that governs a really broad swath of programs related to farming, related to conservation, related to rural areas, agriculture research, and food. This is one of those things that, you know, you could break this apart into, you know, 12 different individual pieces of legislation, into individual bills. But historically, some of these things have been more difficult to pass than others, and you need sort of a broad compromise to pass, you know, these types of, you know, sometimes controversial ideas. So, for example, food stamps or SNAP, this is a really big program that feeds a lot of very poor people, but other people in government don't feel that it's, you know, important enough, or, you know, that the government shouldn't be in the business of doing these kinds of things. So you kind of tie that into programs that those people find important. And in many cases, it's things like support for farmers or conservation programs or research.
And how did the Farm Bill get started? When did this first come about?
Well, it actually started as far back as 1933. So the very first farm bill, it happened right when farmers were going through a really tough time. There was the Depression, and really all of the advancements that hit farmers in the industrial age, from tractors to, to gasoline, all of these things were contributing to increases in productivity. And so you had more and more and more food, and all these surpluses actually caused the prices to drop. And farmers were literally going out of business just doing exactly what they were supposed to be doing. So the government stepped in and said, well, we don't want all our farmers to go out of business. So they ended up buying a lot of the excess surplus from the farmers, and the authority to do that came in the very first farm bill. Subsequently, there was also the Dust Bowl. And so right after you had all the support of farmers who were producing too much, suddenly they couldn't produce anything. So not only could they not pay their rent or their mortgage, but now they couldn't eat either because they literally weren't producing anything. So a second farm bill came along that helped farmers to stay in business, and what they could produce, they could sell to the government at prices that were fair. And then the government could take that extra food and distribute it to people in need. And that kind of set up the very first big compromise that we see in modern farm bills, of both helping out the farmers on the one hand and using any excess food to feed hungry people on the other hand.
That's super fascinating. I had no idea about kind of that surplus at the beginning. I mean, you think that time period, you mostly just think Dust Bowl. So that's amazing. I had no idea. So what did the farm bill look like back then? I know now it's quite a large piece of legislation, but what did it look like back then?
The very first farm bill was really simple. It was just help these farmers out during the Depression, just so that they could stay in business with this oversupply. So help these farmers who are doing the right thing stay in business. It was a very popular program. By 1935, so that farm bill, called the Agriculture Act of 1935, you know, very creative, it gave the USDA the authority just to buy surpluses from farmers, to divert any extra commodities, basically. And commodities are the types of crops that are really important, that are needed, but they also need some processing before they can be consumed. And then they are really stable. They're really shelf stable, so they're easy to store, easy to trade. So it wasn't like the government was in the business of buying, you know, carrots and, you know, cucumbers. They were just really buying the grains, the things that store really well. So they'd buy this surplus to get it out of the market so that it didn't affect prices so much. And then eventually the farmers could buy it back. But, you know, things got more and more complicated as the world got more complicated. You know, they kind of brought this on themselves. So they bought all this food, but then what happens when the farmers can't buy the food back? You know, what happens when the farmers basically go out of business or don't want to buy it back? Well, that's when USDA got the authority to distribute that food to, school lunch programs or families in need. And then, it kind of disappeared for a while, and later it came back right after World War II, actually. There was this problem of readiness. The military was really concerned that a lot of their recruits, these soldiers that could have tried to volunteer in the army, were being denied because of diet-related health issues. So there was this undernourishment or malnourishment problem. And Lyndon Johnson, you know, he said, this is ridiculous. In this country, we shouldn't have malnourishment. So then it became a favorable idea to, again, help farmers out by buying excess crops and those commodities and then distributing them to people in need. And really, I don't think there was political will to help the poor in that way, except in light of this military readiness right after World War II. So, you know, that was a big win for people who care about people in need. And that kind of set up where we are today.
And tell me, where are we today? What does the Farm Bill look like now?
So the modern Farm Bill is, as Elizabeth said, a little more complicated and certainly much larger. The most modern Farm Bills have about 12 titles, and so those are the different sections of the Farm Bill. The titles are different topics, so you have conservation, there's the nutrition assistance, there's horticulture, There's trade, there's rural development, and then, of course, the one that I imagine our listeners will be interested in, the research title. And they're all connected together in this one overarching piece of legislation, the Farm Bill. So I guess, can we give a little background as far as just general how any bill is passed, and then we can kind of talk about the Farm Bill specifically?
Yeah, for sure.
So in the United States, the legislative branch of government is Congress, and it's composed of two chambers, so the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. And generally what happens when you have a piece of legislation, the House and then the Senate will come up with their own versions of that piece of legislation. So that legislation will reflect the priorities of the House or the Senate. They'll pass them through the general specific committees, and then the whole House will vote on its legislation and the whole Senate will vote on its legislation. And then those two pieces of legislation will have to be compromised. So they'll go into a conference process where you have these two different pieces of legislation. They're probably similar, but not exactly the same. And then during this conference process, you're going to hammer out the differences, come up with a final bill that both the House and Senate will pass, and then will be sent to the president for his signature, and it'll be signed into law. So that's exactly what's happening with the Farm Bill. So the Farm Bill, since it is such a big piece of legislation, it's passed every 5 years. So the current Farm Bill will expire on September 30th, so in just a few weeks. And about 2 years before the current Farm Bill expires, both the House and Senate will start having hearings. And hearings are where members of Congress can ask questions, they'll bring in witnesses, they'll want to understand a little bit more about what's working with certain programs, what could potentially be improved. So another thing that we want to talk about with the Farm Bill are the committees that will really have oversight over the Farm Bill. So as you might imagine, one of the committees is the Agriculture Committee, and there's a House Agriculture Committee and a Senate Agriculture Committee. And both agriculture committees are going to be holding hearings, like I said, bringing in witnesses and asking questions to try and understand how this legislation could be improved. So that's been going on for at least 18 months at this point. Committees can receive that information from the hearings. They also ask for input from various stakeholders. The Agronomy, Crop, and Soil Science Societies have submitted testimony. We've submitted letters based on the priorities of our membership. And all of that information is taken into account. The committees then start working on the different sections, the different titles of the Farm Bills, to try and put together their priorities. What do they think this new version of the Farm Bill will look like? What are the programs that they want to change? What are the things that they want to scale back or new programs that they want to propose? And so really that's been going on since the beginning of the calendar year. So both the House and Senate have been putting forward their versions of the Farm Bill. And just in the past spring, both the House and the Senate were able to pass their versions of the Farm Bill. And now we're at the point where they have to hammer out the differences between these two bills. So we're in that conference period. And, you know, we have a few weeks until September 30th to get those differences worked out, but there's still a lot of work to be done before this current Farm Bill expires.
And there are two specific titles that your office works with the most. Can you tell me what they are and where they fit in to the larger Farm Bill?
Well, mainly we work with the research and extension title. And that's, you know, it's funny, it's just really small compared to everything else in the Farm Bill. So the Farm Bill as a whole is close to $1 trillion worth of authorizations, but the research and extension title is just $1.3 billion of that, or at least that's where it was in 2014. So it's just this tiny, tiny piece of it. The lion's share of that $1 trillion is the $756 billion for the SNAP program for nutrition. And then even the programs that support farmers, commodity, conservation, crop insurance, those things, you know, those clock in at basically less than $200 billion total.
Can you tell me more about these committees? I mean, obviously not everybody is on every committee. So how is that decided?
It's usually done through seniority. So if you are a brand new congressperson, you've just, you know, been freshly elected, you will apply basically to committees that you have an interest in or you think are important to your constituents. And usually you get maybe two appointments. It's really based on how much seniority you have. So if the really high-powered committees that, you know, everyone would want to be on are already full, then you don't get those until somebody retires or leaves or is voted out. And then, you know, you can apply, you know, so every couple of years, you'll have kind of some shuffling around of who is on these committees. On the other hand, the longer that you're on the committee, the higher up kind of on the food chain of that committee rank you go. So it is worth it sometimes to stay in one committee for a longer time. And the leadership of your party will sort of help you out, you know, too. If agriculture, for example, is a really important thing for your district, then even if someone has more seniority wants that, you know, they might let you have it anyway for sort of political reasons so that you can keep your seat.
I imagine a lot of our members might think that, oh, I'm sure all the scientists are on the science committee or all the farmers are on the agriculture committee, but it actually, you know, most of the members of Congress don't have a topical background in the committee that they sit on. But yeah, as Elizabeth said, it might be an issue or a topic that is of importance to their district or their constituents.
Sure. Another thing I wanted to talk about with the Farm Bill is funding. So this was something that I didn't know about, like most things related to this, unfortunately. So there's actually different kinds of funding and different ways to kind of talk about funding and whether or not it's actually granted. Can you guys talk about that?
Yeah, we can try to shed some light on this. It is confusing. Okay, let me just say that right away, that it is confusing. Basically, most types of congressional acts that have something to do with money or spending money are called authorizations. So a committee like the Agriculture Committee might get together and they might say, you know what, we think that the USDA's competitive research program should get $700 million a year. AFRI should get $700 million a year. And they can put that into law and everyone can pass it, but that doesn't actually mean that that program will get that amount of money. So, you know, for every committee that has jurisdiction over kind of the policies and the staffing and the structure of, like, for example, USDA or other departments, they don't actually, for the most part, disperse any money. They don't move any money around. They just set kind of a recommended target. And when that bill passes, if the Farm Bill includes that number and that bill passes the whole House and the whole Senate and the whole Congress, you know, you can assume that everybody agrees that that's how much money they should get. And for the most part, that's true. But there are separate appropriations committees, 12 of them in the House and 12 of them in the Senate, that mostly correspond to each other, that actually say, okay, we took into consideration what our colleagues over on the Ag Committee said. We appreciate that this is how much money this particular program should have, but we only have this much money. This is the actual amount of money that's in our budget. And so the appropriations committees, they're the ones that actually tell the Treasury how much money to give to each of these agencies and departments and what to do with it.
Do you have some numbers to throw out as far as typically how close those numbers are?
Yeah, so I think a good example is the competitive research program within USDA, so the Agriculture and Food Research Initiative, AFRI. So in the current Farm Bill, AFRI is authorized, so it has this piece of legislation that gives a recommendation that this program should be funded at $700 million. But in the most recent appropriations process, and that's a yearly process, it's only appropriated to be funded at $400 million. So approximately half of the recommended amount of funding is what it has received at this point.
And does that vary a lot across, like, the different titles? I mean, are some titles more likely to get closer to those numbers, or is that pretty across the board?
How much money certain programs get depends not only on the importance or the popularity of that program, but where that program fits within the greater context. So all agriculture programs are funded in one bill, and that bill has a top line pot of money, and it has to be distributed to all the hundreds of programs within that piece of legislation. So that's what can be a challenge for the Appropriations Committee, is that maybe you want to give more money to one program, but that money has to come from this finite pot. So what program is going to get a cut if you want to increase another one? And so it's really a lot about the priorities, or what that committee thinks are the big, most important or most pressing issues within their bill.
And then there's one other kind of funding, and that's mandatory funding. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. Mandatory funding is basically when a committee that's not an appropriations committee lumps together the authorizations and the appropriations into their bill. So, for example, the Agriculture Committee has a bunch of mandatory programs. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the food stamp program, is one of these mandatory programs. They don't have a specific budget for something like that. The SNAP program basically just guarantees a certain level of financial assistance to poor people, depending on their income, no matter what happens to the economy. So if the economy, dips and more people need assistance, then more assistance will be provided. And there's no, like, until the money runs out kind of problem. It's just, you know, the government will provide. So that's kind of one way to do mandatory funding. But even in the research title of the Farm Bill, there are mandatory research programs. Unlike the SNAP program, these programs do have a number attached to them. So, for example, the Organic Research and Extension Initiative, or the Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Development Initiative, you know, these are mandatory programs. So when the Farm Bill passes, the money is appropriated in there. It doesn't have to go through another appropriations process. And because it doesn't have to go through that yearly appropriations process, putting these mandatory funds into the Farm Bill is sort of like a signal that this is really important or politically sensitive. So, for example, there's a specialty crops research initiative, and it provides like $25 million, I think, to citrus diseases. And right now, citrus greening disease, or Huanglongbing, or HLB, it's a really very important issue for Florida and Texas and California. And so having that guaranteed funding in there for this, you know, really big threat to their industries is something that they don't want to see go through that yearly appropriation slog and risk losing. And so basically Congress is saying, no, we think that this is important enough that we're going to set aside this money sort of in advance.
And how do they choose what is considered a mandatory item? Who's making that decision?
Technically, it is the Agriculture Committee that decides what should be on that list. And it's both the Agriculture Committees in the House and in the Senate that have to, you know, come together and agree on this. But in the end, you know, both houses of Congress have to vote on these bills. And if there are enough people who feel strongly that those things should not be in there, strongly enough to actually vote against the whole package, that would be, you know, a considerable setback.
But they usually get a lot of their recommendations from that information gathering process. So the hearings that happen before the bills are developed, maybe they have a lot of stakeholders that come in, or witnesses that give testimony during that time, talking about the example that Elizabeth used, citrus greening, and really saying that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, and asking the committee members to address it in the Farm Bill.
Hey everyone, hope you're enjoying the show. Interested in learning more? Our Science Policy Office has published several articles about the Farm Bill in their monthly Science Policy column in CSA News, all of which will be freely available on our digital library for the next 2 weeks. You can find a link to those articles and our Farm Bill FAQ in our show notes. Let's get back to the show. So this seems like a good transition point to talk more about what you guys do specifically in the Science Policy Office, because in talking about this, it really becomes clear just how much that data gathering process really drives what's in there, what gets funded as mandatory or not. So can you tell me more about what the Science Policy Office does for each farm bill?
So just talking about this farm bill, because this is a process that happens every 5 years, and I was not here in the policy office and cannot speak to what you guys did here 5 years ago. But last year, we started this process, the survey. We actually reached out to all the society's memberships and asked people, you know, what was important? What should we be focusing on? And not only did we ask what was important to our members, but also what did they think the role of the Science Policy Office was too. So for example, we have a lot of members who are really interested in conservation. Should we in the Science Policy Office also be pushing conservation programs, or should we just be focusing on research funding, for example? So we asked all of these questions and we got basically a pretty strong, coherent list of policy suggestions from our members. Some of them had to do with funding, but a lot of them didn't. You know, there are programs that just weren't structured quite right, or the funding requests for proposals that were coming out of USDA that didn't really meet our members' needs. And those things might or could be addressed through changes in the Farm Bill language. So at that point, we go and meet with the Agriculture Committee staff in Congress and the House and the Senate side. We meet with staffs of the members of the Agriculture Committees, and we talk with them about what our membership has to say. And I think a lot of people who have not done this before or been to Congress are kind of intimidated by this. They think, oh, you know, they're not going to listen to me. They don't really care about what I care about. But the fact is that, you know, when we go into those offices, these staffers, they're generally young people, maybe in their 20s or early 30s. They are incredibly intelligent. They really know their stuff, but they don't necessarily have a background in agriculture research, right? So a lot of them are political scientists, or, you know, even maybe they grew up on a farm. There are people that have expertise in very important places, but they rely on organizations like ours to say, but this is what the scientists need. And they're hungry for that information. So we bring it to them, and they're really actually very appreciative of the kinds of suggestions that we make. And just as one example, one of the things that came out from our survey had to do with research equipment. So I think it was something like 80%+ of our respondents to the survey actually put this as a very high priority, that there was just no easy place to get grants for research equipment. And it used to be that this was part of the Farm Bill. There used to be a program for research equipment grants at USDA, and it stopped being funded. And then when no money was appropriated for it, because again, it could be authorized, but if there's no money appropriated, then the program doesn't exist. So for quite a number of years, there was no money appropriated. And so in the last Farm Bill, they just took out the program entirely. And so we asked if it could be put back in. And we said, we realize that, you know, this is not a mandatory program, so this authorization will need appropriated funds too. But, you know, this is something that's really important to our members. And we are committed to also going to the appropriators and saying, okay, now that this is in the Farm Bill, now that there's an authorization, we really want you to put some money in this program because it's really important for our members. And, you know, and here's why. And what's important about this is if that authorization isn't there, then there's just no way that any money is going to be appropriated for it. It just doesn't work that way. So you can have the authorization without the appropriation, but you're never going to get the appropriation without the authorization first. So that's just one example of how this process works.
In addition to getting input from our society members, one really big role of the Science Policy Office is to interact with other stakeholders within the agriculture and ag research community here in DC and broadly. And so not only did we have priorities that the three societies put together, we also worked with a lot of large stakeholder coalitions to let the Agriculture Committee know these are all the things that we all think are high priority, very important issues that we're asking you to put in the next Farm Bill.
And what is your strategy when you're going in here? I mean, obviously, we have a pretty diverse membership. How do you filter through those to get what you're actually going to push for? And how do you communicate that to people who don't have that background without overwhelming them or just throwing a whole big long list at them?
I mean, part of it was the survey. We could go crazy and have a laundry list of 100 things that would impact our members, but we have to be selective. And when we go to talk to congressional staffers, you know, it's not just about overwhelming them, because, I mean, again, these are really smart people who know their stuff. But if we have a laundry list of things that's going to represent, you know, $1 billion, they're not going to take you seriously. But if you have a really targeted list of just a couple of programs, you know, some of which may have numbers or funding attached to them, but some of which don't, they're going to take you a lot more seriously. They're going to say, okay, I can see that these are really important to you. So the survey was incredibly helpful because it helped us figure out what things were most important to most members. And it helped us figure out where we in the Science Policy Office should really target our approach. In the end, we came up with basically a two-pager of ideas. And again, as Julie said, it wasn't just our membership. We also coordinate with these other groups, because really the more people who are behind your particular numbers or your particular ideas, the more powerful it is.
Julie, anything to add on that one?
Just how you want to talk about it to the members of Congress themselves. You know, are you going to talk about the economic impact, about the impact on maybe the next generation of the STEM workforce? There are certain ways to make this ask that might resonate more with certain members based on what issues they think are important, what issues their constituents think are important. So there certainly is strategy when we're having these discussions and making these asks to the different members of Congress.
Can you give an example of some of the specific items that you guys push for then?
Sure. So as Elizabeth said, one of the most requested topics in our member survey was for this equipment grant funding program. So that was a very high priority in our goals. That was something that we talked to both the House and Senate during the kind of data gathering period, and it was very well received. We got a lot of interest from the congressional staff when we talked about this funding mechanism, and it actually is a big victory. So this was something that we pushed for. And this equipment grants program, authorized at $5 million, is in the House version and in the Senate version. So this is an issue that they don't even have to compromise on. Both versions of the bill have it. So we feel very confident that it will be in the final version. We're obviously still making sure that we let the committees know and the staff know that this is something we do definitely want in the final bill. So that was a great success. Another issue that we thought was really important was the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research. That's a program that just originated in the previous farm bill. So it was basically a program that was given an initial investment of money, and it was told to match it from outside sources, so public funding, to really try to answer some new research questions. The societies have been very supportive of the foundation, and we think it's doing really good work. So we encouraged the House and Senate to include a little more of an investment for the foundation in this next farm bill. Now, this was an issue where the House bill didn't include any additional money for the foundation, but the Senate bill did. The Senate bill included an extra $200 million for the foundation. So this is another instance where during this conference period, where the differences are being worked out, we're going to make sure that we let committee members know and the congressional staff know that we really think that the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research is a high priority. We want them to give this additional money so that it can continue working in the future.
We've talked a little bit about where we are with the current farm bill, but what are some of the specific challenges that you see with this current farm bill?
As I said already, we're very close to the finish line as far as we're working out the differences between the House and Senate bills. We are close to when the current farm bill expires, but unfortunately, there are some really big differences in these two bills. And they're not differences in the research title. They're differences in other programs and other issues that are generally more political, more contentious, and where exactly those issues come out, that's going to be a big part of the success or failure of whether this bill gets passed before the deadline. But we're really hopeful. We've heard from everyone we meet with that both committees are really trying to get this done before the deadline. We would certainly encourage our membership to weigh in if they think that this is an important issue. There's still time left, and the biggest motivator is if members of Congress hear from constituents that this is an important issue, that I think can really go a long way in whether we get a farm bill passed before the deadline.
So with these deadlines, it's to pass the farm bill, and you mentioned that certain programs are tied into that. So can you tell me what are some of the consequences if it does not pass in time?
So the farm bill is set to expire on September 30th. What this means is that when it expires, if nothing is there to replace it, then all of the types of programs, crop insurance, subsidies, price supports, all these things that farmers depend on when they plant crops, go away. This is actually a really huge deal. I mean, this goes back to, like, you know, the 1930s. The farmers will be very upset if Congress is not able to just pass, you know, a farm bill that includes these types of supports. And not to mention the SNAP program, of course, too. So this is not one of those cases where things will go on sort of as they are right now. This would be a real disaster for the economy, for the farm economy, for everything. There is a possibility that if Congress couldn't work out its differences and pass a farm bill, they might be able to have some kind of extension to just kind of keep things going sort of at those levels. While that might work for some things, it would still be very difficult for other things. For example, for research, you know, does USDA grant any grants if it doesn't actually know how much money it's going to end up having in its pot to disperse? So, you know, this is a really dangerous kind of path to walk down. So that's what would happen if we didn't pass a farm bill.
But we do want to emphasize that there is a significant desire to get the farm bill passed. Both House and Senate have discussed that they really want to try and finish it before the deadline. So I think there is still certainly an opportunity and time for constituents, like the people listening, to weigh in and encourage members of Congress that this is an important issue and encourage them to finish the farm bill before the deadline.
And going off of that, I've got three questions left for you. First of all, if people want to be more involved in this, what can people do, both as just the general public, as members of our societies? Can you talk about that?
Well, the great thing about this country is that we're a government of the people, so there's always opportunities for citizens to weigh in. We really encourage our members, but certainly anyone, to reach out to their members of Congress and let them know that this is an issue that's important to you. I think we talked a little bit about that some people might be intimidated about this process, but if you Google whatever your zip code is, that you can find who your two senators and your representative are, and every single congressional website has usually down at the bottom of the page a contact me button where it lists phone numbers, it lists email. If you feel a little uncomfortable actually calling your member of Congress, you can just send an email. And something as simple as the farm bill focuses on programs that impact rural America, that impact anyone who uses our food system, and certainly researchers like me, I would encourage you to do everything you can and work with your colleagues to pass a farm bill before the deadline. you know?
I also want to point out that I've talked to quite a few people who, as soon as we say, you should reach out to your congressperson, they say to me, well, I can't do that. I work for the government. I can't do that. I work for a national lab. That is not an excuse. Any U.S. citizen is allowed to reach out to their congressperson and tell them what they think. There is no rule, there is no law, there is no ethical problem with that. Clearly, if you are, for example, a USDA employee, you can't say, as a USDA employee, I want you to do X, but you can say, as a citizen and as a constituent of yours, as a voter, you know, I want you to do everything you can to pass a farm bill. I want you to consider agriculture research when you pass a farm bill. You know, you can be as general, as specific as you like, but I just want to encourage everyone that there is no reason that you cannot reach out to your congressperson. And in fact, this misperception is so widespread that many scientists don't feel like it's their place to reach out, but it is absolutely your place and your duty, because if you're not doing it, nobody is.
Right. And you guys also have, for people who are really interested in getting involved, some programs that the Science Policy Office offers. Can you tell me a little bit more about those?
We do. We have several opportunities where society members can get involved. But probably the easiest is to sign up for our Legislative Action Network, or our LAN. Those are really the people who have identified that advocacy and policy issues are of interest to them. We send them quarterly newsletters. We send them what we call action alerts. So if there's an issue coming up that we really want to activate our members and ask them to reach out to their members of Congress, we send that out through an email list. We also have a new platform that we debuted at last year's annual meeting, where you can receive these action alerts on a text message. So where you would literally receive a text message, you could hit the link, send, and you would send an email off to your member of Congress right from your smartphone, which is really cool. And it's a new level of advocacy that I think we're exploring now as the societies, which we're really excited about. We are going to be launching an advocacy alert about the farm bill now that we know which members of Congress are serving on this compromise, this conference committee. So we're going to link to those members of Congress. And if you are listening and you think this is important and your member is on that list, you are definitely someone that we would encourage to reach out to your member of Congress and encourage them to make research a high priority in the farm bill. You could certainly ask them to include the funding for the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, as we mentioned. We have a section of the policy websites. So each society has a science policy section, and there's a big section on farm bill policy. So it lists where we are in the process. It has a great FAQ. And then we'll also be linking to our action alert within that section of the website as well.
Do you have to be a member of our tri-societies to get any of those, or can people sign up if they're just a general member of the public?
The LAN is the member benefit, but we would certainly encourage that if you think this is an issue that's important, that's one of the benefits of being a society member, is that you have this whole network of policy and advocacy opportunities that you have access to.
And then there's also two USDA leadership opportunities you guys have in the works. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah, we have two programs right now. One of them is exclusively for undergraduate members, and that's our NIFA internship program. So it's any three-month period, and anyone who's an undergraduate or within two semesters of graduating is eligible to apply. You can find that on the awards page. So for example, agronomy.org/awards or crops.org/awards, etc. And the other program is a fellowship opportunity. So this is for members who already have a PhD. This is a program that you could work at NIFA either full-time if you wanted to, or as part of a sabbatical, for example, or you could just spend a couple of weeks every quarter going to Washington, D.C. and work with NIFA. So we have both of those opportunities open right now on our awards page. And yeah, we would encourage anyone who's interested in seeing how policy in D.C. works, seeing how NIFA programs work, to apply.
And what does NIFA stand for?
NIFA is the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and it's the USDA's agency responsible for the competitive research grants.
Perfect. So that was actually many more than three final questions, but moving on to the second of our quote-unquote three. So we've talked about some of what members can do, but what about for people who are just part of the interested public? Where can they really dig in and learn more about these issues, the Farm Bill in general? What are some resources, or even for a researcher or a member, where can they learn more?
Well, I'm just going to start by saying that when I first moved to Washington, D.C., I borrowed a book called Congress for Dummies, and it, like, changed my life. So if you're interested in, like, the process, and this is not just, like, the, you know, I'm just a bill sitting on Capitol Hill kind of process, but really the process of how it really works, how advocacy works. If you really want to get something done, how would you go about doing it? I found it incredibly useful. So in general, for any issue, I would strongly recommend just checking that out.
And I would also encourage anyone, even if you're not a member, to check out the policy section of the Three Societies websites. We have a section, once again, that focuses on Farm Bill policy, the background, where we're at in the process, and I think that provides a great just introduction to the Farm Bill because, as Elizabeth has discussed, it has a long history. It can be a pretty complicated topic. So I think just getting a little bit of background can be really helpful if someone might want to get involved.
And then final question is, can you tell me a fun fact about each of you?
Of course. I love to sing, and I actually started an a cappella group for science and engineering graduate students in grad school. And even after grad school, I have competed in the DC Karaoke League. So that's one of my favorite hobbies.
I didn't even realize there was a league.
We take everything very competitively in DC. If you can potentially get
That's
a trophy,
true.
We're going to try and get a trophy here in DC.
So true. So I guess I ride my bike to work every day. I guess that's my fun fact. Rain or shine, I'm not like fast or competitive, but I do it. And I also, as I think I mentioned before, I also love food. I love eating food. I love cooking food. So, I cook a lot. And now that I have an almost 3-year-old little boy, he helps me in the kitchen doing with all my cooking.
Those are some great fun facts. And this has been such a fascinating conversation. I have learned so much in preparing for this and even now just doing the interview with you guys. So thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
You bet. Thanks for having us. This was really fun.
Yeah, thanks so much, Abby. We really enjoyed it.
Wonderful. Thank you for listening to Field Lab Earth. You'll find a link to today's paper and other resources for this episode in our show notes or on our website. If you have any questions, comments, or recommendations for show topics, please contact us at podcast@sciencesocieties.org or on Twitter @FieldLabEarth. If you'd like to hear more content like this, please subscribe, and don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes or anywhere else you find your podcast if you like our show. This podcast is a joint production of the Tri-Societies, the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, and Soil Science Society of America. Special thanks to Lobo Loco for the use of their song Spook Castle on the intro and outro of our show. Opinions and conclusions expressed by authors are their own and are not considered as those of the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, Soil Science Society of America, its staff, its members, or its advertisers. Thank you.